Hello and welcome to another episode of the Watermill Theatre podcast. I'm Danielle Pearson, I'm the playwright in residence here at the Watermill. In this episode, we're going behind the scenes on the Watermill's revival of Twelfth Night, which opens at Wilton's Music Hall this week. Here's artistic director Paul Hart on how he's been working with the Watermill's very own Shakespeare Ensemble to create this production.
So the way that we're approaching Twelfth Night that might be slightly different to other productions people have seen before is the cast not only speak the text, but they're also all act musicians. So there is live music throughout. And we've set the play in a sort of Victorian music hall. So the characters can live their fantasies through song, as well as playing play alongside that.
This production is the third outing for the Watermill Shakespeare Ensemble, a group of young and ridiculously talented actor musicians who've been starting a quiet revolution here in Berkshire with their unique take on the plays. Whereas once it was common for British actors to cut their teeth in the world of regional rep, the chance to work as a company on a series of plays has largely fallen out of fashion these days. Here's Paul on the thinking behind his choice to start a brand new ensemble company.
We formed the Shakespeare Ensemble a couple of years ago now. Romeo and Juliet was the first thing I did as artistic director at the Watermill. And we did it with quite a young group of actors who approached that play in a particular way. We were looking at youth and we wanted to work with that group of people again. So I chose a play that would work, again, approached from that perspective of a group of young people. And I like the idea that Romeo and Juliet was really modern and Twelfth Night could be set in more of a historical period. So we've gone for the 20s, which has been done before because it works brilliantly with the idea of, you know, the Bright Young Things era. And then we've given it a sort of modern contemporary twist with songs from now but done in a 20s style. So that was the way into it.
While music is vital to almost every Watermill production, in the case of Twelfth Night, it was the first step of the process.
When I'm working on a Shakespeare, I always start by just building a playlist of the kind of music that might work with that piece. In my head, the starting point was that there is a kind of music hall, jazz club world that is happening all the way through alongside the events of the play. So there are sort of moments of characters stepping out from the domestic day-to-day stuff of the play to then share with an audience their kind of ultimate fantasy.
Here's Paul, musical director Ned Rudkin-Stowe, and Peter Jukes, who plays Malvolio, on how they've reimagined modern music into the world of the play, and how they've used it to explore the inner workings of complex, ambivalent characters like Malvolio.
It was Paul's idea, really. We got a lot of influence from postmodern jukebox, because they do this really cool thing of taking modern songs and putting a complete flip on it. And in the same way, those modern songs, some of the lyrics in them and the content really lend themselves to the characters' sort of desires and fantasies. So we thought if we can take those songs but sort of fit it within the setting that we've got, which is this 1920s Illyria, this jazz Illyria, it can hopefully show a bit more of the characters through music.
The relationship between the play and music is so strong anyway, if music be the food of love, play on. So it all builds from the fact that Orsino is trying to express his love and his emotion through music. When moments of real emotion and connection to each of the characters happen, this idea that we'll flip into a fantasy cabaret style thing, which is very much what like Royal is like for Malvolio.
So my favourite sort of example of that is at the end of Act One, when Malvolio sings Royals, which is this moment of him just dreaming what could be and everything that he might be able to be in a world where he's not constricted by the rules of society. So it becomes quite a kind of full-on opportunity for him to share that very directly with an audience, really.
It's a first clarity of release of emotion that you really see from him in the entire play. He's playing the stickler the whole time, but then that moment when he's allowed to, he's been given permission to be himself, for Malvolio, that's his moment of clarity. It's the moment that he goes, I can express myself, and that's where that fantasy moment happens and that music comes through. And we'll never be royals.
to run in our blood. That kind of luck's just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler. You can call me Queen Bee, and maybe I'll rule. Let me live that fantasy.
The kind of nature of storytelling is the most important thing to us. It's really key that we kind of make sure, first and foremost, that we're telling the story in as sort of clear a way as possible. So all the songs are there to help kind of illuminate the narrative in some way, really.
Chatting to members of the ensemble, I've been really struck by the versatility of this cast. There's classically trained Shakespeare nerds, there's reformed Shakespeare haters, there's people whose background has been more musically focused. It seems to have been a really liberating process for them all. And I think a big part of that is Paul's commitment to a 50-50 gender split in casting. Shakespearean characters that have been reimagined as females so far include Friar Lawrence, Bottom, and in this production, Sir Toby Belch. Now, if I'm being honest, I've never warmed to Toby. I've always found his jokes to be dated, like watching a Dave rerun 400 years in the future. So I was surprised, in watching the original run of Twelfth Night, to find that Lauren Redding's Toby Belch is genuinely funny and actually moving. Her Toby is a washed-up music hall MC, longing for her glory days. Here's Paul and Lauren on how that changes the dynamics of the play.
So for Toby, we're exploring the idea that she is a kind of music hall MC and has had this sort of amazing career and been incredibly popular and used to telling jokes and being loved by the masses, and that career has sort of dwindled slightly, and you know, because everything's been sort of blown up and left behind, really. So she's kind of remembering what she used to have and has turned to drink to kind of get through, really.
Toby was a massive star. She was this MC kind of music hall star, and now she isn't. And what that does to somebody who has once been, you know, on the billboards. She does turn to alcohol, she turns to addiction and to get that feeling back. So with our production, we're playing with the idea of reality and fantasy, and we often go into Toby's head. So we go into old kind of music hall Toby, where she's got a band and she's going for it and she's having a right good time, and then all of a sudden back to the reality where she's drunk. And it's sad. It is sad. I think addiction is sad. I think that kind of demise of somebody's career is sad. But she finds the humour. Often people hide behind humour, don't they? And a lot of comedians are often the saddest people you'll meet. And I think that's what she hides behind.
One, two, three.
There's also this amazing love story between her and Mariah, which is obviously in the 20s completely illicit and kind of under the radar. And then you find out at the end of the play that they've gone and got married in some form. So that's been a really exciting thing to play around with and look at in this new context.
In this production, obviously, Toby Belch is female, and Mariah and Toby still get it on, still have an affinity there and end up getting married, which obviously back in the day was not a thing that happened. The way Toby sees her, she is in love with her, but back in that day, there was no chance that that would ever happen. That was not conceivable. So she tries to set her up with Andrew, but there's something there and it's undeniable, and it's a really intense magic relationship that they've got. And it comes, the hierarchy of Toby is up there. She's the sister of the man of the house who's passed away, Olivia's dad, and Mariah is a maid, but it just disappears and disintegrates into, you know, love is love, isn't it? And it'll come where it comes, and there's no hiding it.
Georgia, Georgia, that old sweet song, just that old sweet song, puts Georgia on my mind.
Given that they run the whole gamut from people who've always loved Shakespeare and those who have struggled with him in the past, the ensemble are always looking for ways to make Shakespeare accessible to new audiences. Here's Paul, Lauren, and Victoria Blunt, who plays Mariah, on what The Watermill in particular can bring to this.
I think part of the reason for setting up the ensemble was because I felt that the way that we were able to approach Shakespeare at the Watermill was quite different to anywhere else. We don't have the kind of pressure of, you know, major institutions having an expectation about Shakespeare being presented in a particular way. And it's always felt like the Watermill is somewhere where you can take risks with Shakespeare and how you do it. And for me, it's about, you know, playing the text really well, getting people who speak verse brilliantly, but also finding a kind of musical language to that. And by employing people who are also amazing musicians, it's incredible the way in which they pick up on the rhythm of the text in a very natural way. So in terms of the sort of Watermill tradition, I suppose it's kind of merging two of the things that the Watermill was most famous for, which is actor musicianship and Shakespeare, and finding a way of doing these incredible famous plays that I felt hadn't been explored elsewhere.
Fly away, breath. I am slain by a fair, cruel maid. My shroud of white, stuck all with you. Oh, prepare it.
I think the ensemble and musical nature of our approach to Shakespeare just makes it accessible. And I love Shakespeare, but I never understood Shakespeare till I was... I always thought, oh, I can't get Shakespeare because, you know, I'm dyslexic and it doesn't make sense. And then I remember going to see a Propeller version, which obviously they started at the Watermill, and I went, I didn't get it all, but I got it. I know what happened. And I think that's what Paul's really great at doing and what the Watermill Ensemble are great at, just cracking it open, you know? And I think once you open that door and you let audiences in and you don't be all stuffy and like, oh, we understand Shakespeare, darling. Like, it's for everyone. It was written for the people. And now, for some reason, people think it's about la-di-da, but actually, it's still for the people. And the music, especially with this, we're doing kind of postmodern jukebox songs, so modern-day songs in the sound like of the 20s. It just, people's ears just go and they go, oh, I know this, so I can be part of this. It's just letting people in, and that's why we do a pre-show. That's why we open with letting people in and making them part of it. It's not a passive experience. We want you to come with us. We want you to be part of it. It's not immersive in the sense of that way. You are sat in an auditorium, but we want you to be in our world. We want you to be there. And that's why I think the Watermill Ensemble and Paul are great at just cracking it open for that.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I like to hear. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Elephant Jazz Club. You're very welcome. Now is your opportunity to have a dance. The stage is yours. I mean it.
I've never really liked Shakespeare. I always hated it. I really didn't get it at school. I thought it was just for really posh, clever people, and that it wasn't really aimed for people like me. And I avoided it like the plague. And then about 3 years ago, I met Paul, and he completely changed my mind on it all. And he sort of unlocked something that made it immensely enjoyable to be a part of and to watch. And yeah, I think as an ensemble, we're trying to make work that excites new audiences as well as satisfying older audiences. And it's about breaking down the barriers that we feel are either self-imposed or have been imposed by watching a lot of productions that maybe haven't catered to the audiences and that have made things feel a bit inaccessible, by using things like modern music and finding ways to bring the audience in a bit more, to open it up, and yeah, to just make it feel more relevant. And I think part of that's achieved in gender switching, part of it's achieved in the fact that we're all quite young, we come from really different backgrounds, different training, different skill sets, different strengths, and none of us understand it when we read it. There's a huge amount of time we spend breaking it down and figuring it out and finding the ways of communicating things as easily as possible to an audience. Which I hope will change a few people's minds on Shakespeare as it did on mine.
Along with music, movement has always played a big role in the ensemble's process. Paul's assembled a team of young, exciting creatives off stage as well as on to bring these plays to life. Here's movement director Tom Jackson Greaves on how he approaches movement in Shakespeare's plays.
Working with the Watermill Ensemble is my first experience of working on Shakespeare as a movement director. And so I absolutely adore Shakespeare, and I think some of his stories are the most exciting stories, Twelfth Night being one of my complete favourites. I just love it. But I also am someone that does struggle with the language and can kind of go through stages of really loving the poetic nature of it and sometimes really struggling to understand. And I think that's quite a universal thing, especially for young people experiencing Shakespeare for the first time. I quite wanted to use the movement to tell parts of the story without language, so that people can kind of connect in other levels as well, in other ways. So the shipwreck and the storm at the beginning was really helpful, I think, to kind of set up that storyline, because we go from Orsino's jazz club with this kind of 20s social dancing, and the party kind of starts to break down, and then we do this really dramatic shift straight into the shipwreck and the storm, and it is quite abstract, but people got it straight away. And that kind of language of doing it without text, so you see the kind of starts of a story through movement, and then we can plough into the story with the language. That, I think, was quite exciting and helpful. And that's, I think, something that we're trying to do more and more with the ensemble, actually, is use movement to tell the story in conjunction with the language, not in opposition, completely kind of in parallel and working with the Shakespearean language, but in a way that can then let people who have either not seen Shakespeare before, struggle with Shakespeare, kind of have a way in where they go, oh, I get what's happening, because I can visually connect up those dots.
So we've heard the idea behind the ensemble, but what's it like in practice to live and work with the same people on multiple shows?
As an ensemble, we've been working together for 3 years now, and I think it's very apparent every time you get back into the room together, you're starting from that little bit further down the line, really, just in terms of people's confidence with each other, in terms of just people's confidence with the text, but also their ability to take risks around each other. I think you just go a bit further each time. So it's a really kind of unique thing. And, you know, I find quite often that when you're looking at Shakespeare, first day of rehearsal, everyone comes in and they've sort of got their own way of doing Shakespeare. And we're sort of finding more and more collaboratively that there's a way that we like to do things, and there's a speed with which you're able to work the more you do together. I think that makes quite a big difference. And coming back to something after you've looked at a different play as well, you get a kind of richer understanding of the way in which Shakespeare writes and the way in which you are able to kind of crack that open and understand it more readily in a way that you can start to communicate it to an audience. But it's also just really fun. Like, today's the first day of rehearsals, just meeting up with everyone, you kind of, it doesn't feel like the first day of school like it usually does. It feels like you're starting from a point where you have something that already exists and you can just make it better, which is really exciting.
I love working as an ensemble. I've always wanted to do rep forever. I think it's an amazing thing to do. We're like a, it sounds really cheesy, but we do become like a family, and you do sort of, especially at the Watermill, when you're living together, inevitably you're working all the time. I have this thing where everyone in my phone, because when you meet each other at the Watermill, when it's a new person, you know, you kind of don't learn names. I don't learn names very quickly, I'm terrible. So everyone's surname in my phone is Watermill. So it is like they're just a really big family. Ned Watermill, Lily Watermill, like they've all got the same surnames. You have a shorthand of working together that's really helpful, and I think things just get done a lot faster. And you know each other's strengths, and you equally know each other's weaknesses, and so you can push that, you can challenge each other. You know, we've just come off the back of doing Midsummer Night's Dream, and you know that anything you did in that show that worked is gone. Like, you can't recycle any ideas. You've got to be, everyone knows who you are and what you bring, and it's an added excitement that you can challenge yourself to still make those people laugh. I certainly feel, anyway, much more open to taking huge risks and really, you know, there's nothing worse in a rehearsal room when you put yourself out there and try something and it falls flat and it's just so embarrassing. And we just have a little, we call it strong and wrong, and you've just got to go in really strong, and if it's wrong, that's fine.
Well, maybe this time, if you've got that moment up there with Olivia,
there is a,
so then that journey down to it, oh, yeah.
There is a step forward. And Vic, like, changes direction.
That's it.
Thank you.
That's so
just
going
to go.
Yeah. You go to that, go, go on.
He's a gentleman.
Yeah.
Gentleman here. No, that's down then. Nope.
Yeah.
I couldn't leave without asking what's next for this ambitious young company. What would an actor-musician tragedy look like? What about the history plays? We caught up with the cast and asked them which plays and roles would be on their Shakespearean wish list.
That's the nice thing about all of this and being involved in it, is that I don't really feel like there's any limitations anymore. I'd love to play Richard III. That's always been a big one. I'd love to play Iago. There's not really many female characters I want to play anymore. I think that's the thing, when you start tearing down the barriers like Paul's done, it just makes you hungry for, like, to aim higher and just think, yeah, why not?
I love Hamlet's my favourite play. I don't know whether I don't think I would ever be cast as Hamlet. I don't know, maybe he'd ever go at that. It's my dream role in Shakespeare.
I mean, I would absolutely love to play Hamlet, Paul, if you're listening.
I like the cross-gender stuff that we're doing, and I think that's exciting. And I'd love to kind of play, you know, I'd love to play like a female Hamlet. I would love that.
So, Paul, if you're listening, that Hamlet audition sounds like it's going to be pretty competitive. Twelfth Night is now playing at Wilton's, a genuine East London music hall, which brings the atmosphere of a 20s jazz club to life. Here's Paul and Lauren on why Wilton's is the perfect venue for this version of Twelfth Night.
Wilton's is the perfect space for us to transfer to. So I think Wilton's as a space is going to bring so much to this particular piece, because it is the kind of space that me and Katie, the designer, had in mind when we were designing it. And it's similar to the Watermill in a lot of ways, but a slightly bigger version, I suppose. But the sense of history when you walk into the place is so apparent. And I think that's really key to this piece, that you kind of understand where you are, at least in terms of an atmosphere, because that 20s period where you can imagine bombed out buildings and the kind of backstory of what we've created around the story just sits very neatly in that space, I think. And I think it will feel like, you know, a real party, but also the balance of that and it feeling quite sombre at times is really important in this play. It's the kind of perfect balance of every emotion, and I just think it will sit really well in the space from that point of view. And the music hall stuff will just come to life, and we're looking at staging that slightly differently to kind of make the most of the venue, really.
I can't wait to perform at Wilton's. I remember going there about 7 or 8 years ago and walking in, and just, I just got goosebumps walking into the place, because our production is set, you know, that the pre-show will be in the music hall, we'll be doing it. And with Toby's relationship to music and Toby's relationship to performance, it's going to be so much fun to be able to do it on that stage. And the acoustics in there as well, that's one thing I'm really excited about. And that's going to be so nice to actually just open your lungs and just smash it out.
No sir. song I have found, it's just that old sweet song puts Georgia on my mind. Mind Georgia on my mind.
Twelfth Night is at Wilton's Music Hall until the 22nd of September. To find out more about the Watermill and its productions, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or check out our website. This podcast was presented by me, Danielle Pearson, and produced and edited by Imogen Greenberg. We'll be back with more Watermill stories soon, so make sure you subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.